Iran is prepared for a long war, for a marathon. I think the same strategy we've seen with the Russian army so far. They're not that much in rush to, but they're prepared to defend themselves. That's why you see some sort of calmness. You look at today, everything was normal in Iran. You know, we had, on the other hand, the Israeli mayor coming to the live and somehow breaking down on live. Yeah, you know, crying that what is happening here? But you don't see that sort of panic in Iran. To be honest, you don't see that. You follow the Iranian media, the Persian media, you don't see any sort of panic. You see the destruction, you see the death, but you don't see the panic. This is the problem. And that the Trump administration doesn't understand, in my opinion. And the other, I think when it comes, Carol, to the numbers, it matters when you go underground. It doesn't mean, you know, the air power is important, but what you have underground is much more important to capture the land, to sustain that sort of, you know, capturing. What is your understanding of the numbers that they're providing to the region? Because it's, after all, that's a huge factor in the calculation.
Well, at least publicly, what's publicly known is in terms of ground forces, there is around 3,000 82nd Airborne Troops from the Ready Brigade. There's around 7,000 combat Marines from two Marine Expeditionary Units, and then some unknown number of special forces like Army Rangers. So maybe around 11,000 total personnel that are involved in this. And that's not necessarily trigger pullers, you know, people that could actually fight, but that's the total force number, because a lot of that's command and control, headquarters, supply, logistics, and that kind of thing. So it's a lot less than that actual ground troops that would be, you know, with carrying rifles or whatever. But these are all light, every one of them. So that's something that you can use to, I mean, these guys are designed, really every one of these, to go in and seize operations or seize pieces of terrain or like seize an airfield, et cetera, only as part of a larger force so that heavier forces can come that can sustain that. These forces are not designed to go seize something and stay there for an extended period of time or to create a bridgehead and then launch out on some sort of conquering mantra beyond that and, you know, and get something else. They only seize a bridgehead, but you have to have other forces. And that's the weird part. There aren't any other forces in the region. There's nothing else that once you take something, where is the exploitation forces? Where would you go? What would even be the objective? I mean, let's just say Kargil, and that's what people are talking about the most. But, okay, there's, you know, 90% of the oil is offloaded there for the Iranian regime. But that's not the only place that they can get their oil out, number one. And number two, and I'd love to hear your talk on this, what would the loss of some percentage of their ability to get oil out. I mean, with all these sanctions, seems like they're kind of accustomed to getting by on less. We'll see how that works out. But so what would we gain by that? Is that going to put pressure on the Iranian side that is not already there? I don't see it changing any dynamic at all. So I don't know what you would gain if you succeeded. But I mean, I've seen from IRGC leaders, I've seen some political leaders in Iran that are basically saying, Abbas Araghchi, actually, more than a week and a half ago, he was one of the first people that I saw that was asking about this. And he's like, yeah, bring it on. Are you kidding? Yes, absolutely. We wait for the Americans on the ground. You can say on the one hand, well, that's just braggadocio. That's just putting on a brave face publicly because there's a public relations war going on too. But I'm putting myself in their position, taking the flags off and just looking at this from a military perspective, you know, side A and side B, and take all the hubris out of all of it. I'm thinking if I'm on the Iranian side, side B, I'm like, man, I have every advantage in the world. It's on my home turf. I've got all of these huge mountain ranges, which provide enormous defensive capabilities. I know the territory here. I have no logistic lines. Everything is right there. They're coming from thousands of miles away. They have to keep this logistic bridge going on all over the place. Gas, fuel, ammunition, everything's got to come from a long way away. They don't know the terrain. And so you go out here, and I mean, I'm talking rocket artillery, because any of these islands are going to be in range of ground forces as well, the continental forces. So you got long-range artillery, drones of who knows how many categories, short-range missiles, medium-range missiles, long-range missiles that could range from anywhere in the country, all could converge wherever they say. It could be a weapons nightmare on whatever force lands on there, whether they're successful or not. And then how would you sustain it over time if you did take it? So everything militarily to me says this is a disaster in the making. And I don't know why we would want to choose to fight this battle.
Carol, here is what the U.S. ambassador to NATO said about forcing NATO allies to join the fight.
Is, you know, we've been in overdrive here diplomatically, pushing our allies both here in Brussels and across capitals in Europe and in the Middle East to convince everybody. Unfortunately, it took some convincing that this is more important to them than it is to the United States. I mean, you know, we get very little, if any, oil through the Strait of Hormuz. It certainly is affecting, you know, the oil prices of the United States. But that's one of the great things that President Trump was able to do, is to make America energy independent. And that independence obviously guarantees our supply. Now, you know, we have allies that are finally stepping up. I think, you know, from the time this conflict broke out, they were certainly non-committal to what they could bring to the fight or bring to help us. But, you know, they have done things that I think goes sometimes unnoticed. We had several allies here in Europe and in NATO that were providing key and crucial basing, overflight, and access that, whether it's Ceuta Bay, where I was in Greece on the Isle of Crete, or whether it was, you know, other countries, including Germany and France, that were providing, you know, our ability to.
Yeah, he's somehow saying that they have done everything they could, and their assessment is different from the Trump administration's assessment. That's the difference. That's why they're not joining the fight in the Strait of Hormuz. What do you make of it, Carl?
Well, I mean, I'll just tell you right off the bat, if Secretary Hegseth was an embarrassment to me on the military side, this is an embarrassment on the diplomatic side. Because he's talking about, you know, why aren't they doing stuff? And you know, and he tries to make this case, you know, we're protected. I mean, I don't know what's their problem, because they're the ones who get a lot of oil from the Persian Gulf. We're fine because we're energy independent. No, we're not energy independent. We import. I haven't seen the current rate, somewhere between 3 to 5 million barrels per day that we import on top of what we make as well, because that's the mix of different fuels. We have to have that. But secondly, if it doesn't matter, then why is the price of gasoline like nearly a dollar more than it was at the price? Because oil is a global commodity. So it doesn't matter where the oil comes from. It only matters what the global price is. And if the price keeps going up for the world, then it goes up for us too. So everybody in the world, not even just the West, is going to be dependent upon this. But the second thing, and the more important issue, is both diplomatically and militarily, there's a reason why no nation has stood up yet to say they're going to bring military forces of any kind, naval or air power, and definitely not ground power, in to participate in this, because they recognize that it is an unwinnable situation. There is no military solution that we can force open the Strait of Hormuz that's at an acceptable cost in an acceptable time frame. There's a reason why our Navy, with a third of our Navy deployed in this mission so far, according to reports, why haven't we opened it up? And I saw General Jack Keane last week was asked that question, and he said, oh, well, I mean, you know, I mean, we could, but we have global requirements. So if we did all that, then we could do it. Definitely, we could escort those vessels through there, but then we wouldn't be able to do anything else. So we need our help from our allies. But see, we know that's why our ships are way, way out from the shore, because we know that the minute that you bring them, even heading into the Gulf of Oman, even before you get to the straits, I call it like a gauntlet of death with all the shoreline of the Iranian shoreline for, I think it's, you know, 800 miles or something to the car that you would have to navigate through, and, you know, increasingly close ranges when you get closer to the strait and then trying to get up to Karg, et cetera. You're not going to be able to drive a ship. I'm there even to get to Karg Island for an offensive operation, much less a permanent escort mission. And by all accounts, you did, and I think we did this in the 1980s with the operation where Reagan had, where you need a couple of military escorts for each one of these tankers. And you're talking 100 tankers a day to get the normal flow going in. What Navy has the assets to do something like that, even if you just rolled through the strait, even if there was, they weren't attacked, but everybody knows that they probably would be attacked. And Iran doesn't have to sink every ship. They just got to sink a few of them as a warning. And then the next one's, what tanker is going to be in line to be the third one destroyed? If you hit the first couple, then who's going to be in line to be number three to go to the bottom of the Persian Gulf? No one's going to do that. So it's effectively closed, and it takes so little for Iran to keep it controlled. They don't even have to mine the thing anymore. I think that's like a last-ditch effort. If they got really, really desperate, that they could do that to firmly close it off for everybody. But they don't need to right now. Just the threat of, you know, because there's already been a number of tankers, you know, spectacularly blow up in the Persian Gulf. And, you know, the flames were made great video, which scared everybody. And so now only those that get permission can come through. And that's a limited number so far. So why would anybody in Europe send their ships to do what our own ships won't do, what our ships can't do? Because whatever is said publicly and whatever attempts to shame our allies, like the ambassador was trying to do there, is not going to work, because at the end of the day, the same logic that has kept us from putting our ships into harm's way will keep them from putting their ships into harm's way. So they will agree to some amorphous kind of, you know, support, you know, we're behind you, whatever. We're going to help with, you know, some kind of, I think the Britons said some sort of keep the Hormuz Strait or safe or some amorphous thing like that. But it didn't commit to any kind of hard military power or a time frame, et cetera. And I think that's what you're going to see, because nobody's going to sign up. Nobody diplomatically and politically from Europe could survive if they said, all right, I'm just picking Greece or the UK or France. I'm going to send my ships there. We're with you, President Trump. We're going to, and then they go to the bottom of the sea. Now, how are they going to face their electorate when they're saying, you just killed our sailors from our own country? When the Americans won't even send their own sailors in there. Now they're dead. Our ship's at the bottom of the sea. You know, get out of the office. We're going to, you know, fire you or whatever. Nobody would face that, because that's what would happen if they tried to go against what the IRGC did. There's too many ways that they could damage or destroy those ships.
Carl, I think nobody can deny that the main ally of the United States in Europe is the United Kingdom. And here is the assessment of the former MI6 chief, Sir Alex Younger, about the conflict.
The upper hand right now.
Iran. I regret having come to this conclusion, because like many MI6 officers of my generation, we faced the violence and brutality of the IRGC for most of our careers.
That's the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps.
Yeah. So there is no love lost between us. And I shed no tears for Ali Khamenei, who was killed at the beginning of this war. But the reality is the US underestimated the task, and I think, as of about 2 weeks ago, lost the initiative to Iran. In practice, the Iranian regime has been more resilient than I think anyone would have expected. They took some good decisions, actually, as early as last June about dispersing their military capability and delegating the authority for the use of those weapons, which has given them significant extra resilience against this incredibly powerful air campaign. They have embarked on what's technically called horizontal escalation, i.e. firing rockets at anybody within range, which at the time, honestly, Shawshank, I thought was nuts, but in fact has been a very good way of putting in direct price on the US. Sort of worked. And then they've understood the significance of the energy war and held the straits at threat, and globalized, and essentially not internationalized, just globalized the conflict in a way that gives them some weapons. So, you know, they've played a weak hand pretty well. My second point is that Donald Trump has said some stuff that will have confirmed something they knew already, which is that they're in a civilizational war, in their terms. They're in a war of existence. Donald Trump made it very clear that he wanted to see them up against the wall, basically, whereas America has embarked on a war of choice. And in those terms, I think that's imbued them with more staying power than their U.S. and certainly U.S. counterparts. And they know that now.
Colonel, is there anybody in the United States listening to these people who are criticizing somehow the attitude of the Trump administration?
You know, it's interesting. For all the things you said there, I agree with. I thought one of the more telling statements was early on in there, when he said, you know, I don't think anybody really understood the staying power and the stamina of the Iranian side, that they would be able to be so resilient. And I'm thinking, what do you mean? The only way you would have known that is if you had never paid any attention, or if you believe this caricature that we have of the Iranians as being religious Nazis, that they only want to kill everybody who's not Shia, and that they're just this maniacal group that all they want to do is kill people and get nuclear weapons to kill more people. That's all they want to do, et cetera, and that they're kind of this weak people. If that's your caricature, then you don't view them as actual human beings that have weaknesses and strengths, etc. They're just evil, that they have to be oppressed. But if you had listened to anything that Iran had said in the months or even years prior to this, there would have been no doubt that this would have been the expectation that you could have had, that they would have been this resilient, because they have known for sure the power that the West, the U.S. and Israel bring to bear and could reap havoc. And that's why they had all these, for decades, underground facilities, these underground cities. They have been resourced. They have been stockpiled. They have the industrial capacity underground where it continue on. They're not foolish to think that they're going to put stuff in buildings on the ground that can be easily destroyed by our capabilities. They have certainly known that. So they foresaw all of that. And then they had their military assets decentralized into, I believe it's 31 different military districts spread throughout the country. They had political decentralization. They had a plan for decapitation, what would happen in the interim, what would be the path of whatever. I mean, they had everything marked down. And I think, as you actually pointed out on our show here recently, look at the 8 years of the Iran-Iraq war. If you want to know how the Iranian people will react, look what they did during that long time period where many, and I understand scores of leaders of various ranks were assassinated or killed. Hundreds of thousands of Iranian people sacrificed their lives. They never broke. They never gave in, even though they had incredible economic hardships. They suffered under our sanctions. They suffer under military strikes, etc. They never broke. Why did we think they would break this time? Why are we surprised by what we've seen here? This is what we should have expected, which, of course, is why I was so adamantly opposed to this and did everything possible in any venue I had to say, don't start this war of choice, because militarily, we don't have the assets or the resources to win it. It was always going to be a fool's errand, and now it's being exposed as being exactly that.
Colonel, since you mentioned the Iran-Iraq war, I remember when I was asking many people what has happened during those days. You know, right after the revolution, it was this war coming up, and many of those commanders who were part of the Shah regime, they were removed from power. So the war was fought by the commander, the main commander of IRGC, or the army. He had 24 years old. Now, it was, you know, look, you cannot, by assassinating the commanders, you cannot achieve anything, in my opinion, because they have this history. They know how to deal with this problem. They fought for 8 years with the commander-in-chief, 24-year-old. That's why I think they don't understand, and everything they consider is coming from the Mossad and Israelis. I don't see any sort of assessment. I don't know how capable Tulsi Gabbard is to provide the president with the, you know, sound and correct information.
Yeah, and just add to that, you know, the Iran-Iraq war, it included the Iranian side had to contend with the ground army, of course, but also air power, economic sanctions, missiles, artillery. I mean, virtually every aspect of a conflict. And this time, there's not an army that they have to contend with. It's missiles and bombs and other kinds of ordnance, but there's no ground army. And this idea that what's coming with the 82nd and the two Marine Expeditionary Units, those are dots on a map. That's not an army. At most, they can seize a location, a spot, an airfield or something, maybe Karg Island temporarily, perhaps. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. That's it, though. if they did everything that we were asking them to do, what are they going to do then? They're not going to expand beyond that. They're not going to like start rolling through the countryside. We don't even have an army of that size, even if we wanted to try. And why would we? Because look what the Iraqi army was not able to do. And I want to say that I think I saw that it would like it's I think the furthest penetration was like 75 miles inside Iranian territory. If I'm not mistaken, you correct me if I am wrong, in like the first year, then it was eventually pushed back. And then it was kind of like the Korean War. It just kind of went back and forth on a certain line for years after that. But even with all the support we gave the Iraqi army, they were never able to make deep penetrations into the country, et cetera. So I don't know why we think that we would be able to do something that they couldn't when we don't even have an army that big. If we could get them in there. And now then, according to information I saw just this morning, a lot of the PMUs, the Shia PMUs in Iraq, have now been authorized to self-defend themselves, even against the Americans should they get into. Ergo, it's not like we're going to be able to use Iraq as a staging point to launch a ground invasion should we get foolish enough in the future to think that's an option here. So, I mean, Iraq could be turning against us as well. We'll see how all that plays out. But everything says this is a military disaster of epic proportions for us so far. And we just have to pray that President Trump somehow recognizes that and takes any kind of off-ramp he can get, because this can get a lot worse for us.